You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, this is Tim McMaster taking you around the American League East for MLB.com Extras. A few days after the trade deadline, time to catch up on the buyers and sellers in the American League East. Let's start at the top of the division with MLB.com's Orioles reporter, Brittany Giroli. Brittany, the trade deadline is behind us now. We'll get in a little bit into what the team has done. They've added some pieces, the pieces they needed to, I think. We'll find out if it's the right players as the season plays out, but we knew the Orioles would be challenged as far as who they could get, but they go out and Dan Duquette and company get the job done as far as adding a starter, and they also get a bench piece as far as a bat goes. We'll get into that. I wanted to start, though, with Tuesday night's game and Dylan Bundy, who, since becoming a starter, I mean, this is suddenly the Dylan Bundy that we thought we'd see a couple of years ago before all the injuries derailed his career. Tremendous again for the second straight start. He takes a no-hitter into the game a good amount. 88 pitches on Tuesday, 7 innings, just 1 hit, no runs. He strikes out 7. What stood out the most to you, or the last couple of starts, what has stood out the most to you about what Bundy is doing as a starter?
I think probably how efficient he was on his pitches last night. He threw 88 pitches over 7 innings, but still, that wasn't a career high. He's thrown 89 in the previous one and only gone 5 1/3. So last night he was commanding the ball, Sam, and he was doing it early and often. And you saw the looks on the Rangers' faces. They weren't sure what was happening, what was coming at them. He had 3 pitches going and moving well. And I think for Dylan Bundy to do that against a team as good as the Rangers were certainly said a lot about what he's capable of.
Yeah, I mean, that is an impressive lineup that the Rangers have, and it was maybe even more impressive after the deadline as they've added more pieces to that team. You mentioned the 88 pitches. As far as pitch count goes at this point, because obviously they've been lengthening him out after being a bullpen guy most of the season. Granted, he was a long guy, but what's the limit at this point? Was that about it for last night? Is he at the point where maybe next start he can push 100?
He could, yeah. I think the big thing is going to get him up over 90. It's funny because he had that no-hitter going for a while last night, and Buck said that, you know, he'd never tell if he was relieved or not that Bundy finally gave up a hit. But no matter what, he said the seventh was going to be Bundy's last inning. I think they're being very cautious with him, but they're doing a good job. They've really done this all year. He's really been treated as a starter, even when he was in the bullpen. So I would imagine maybe getting into the 90s, probably not pushing it to the hundreds unless it's an easy 100 this next time out, but he's getting close to really just starting to let it go.
Because of the way this has worked out with him being in the bullpen, the Orioles kind of avoid a situation that other teams have run into with guys coming back from injuries. I mean, we obviously, the famous situation is Steven Strasburg being shut down by the Nationals because of the innings limit and missing the postseason. But even look at this season in the division, at some point, the Blue Jays are going to move Aaron Sanchez, who has arguably been their best starter all season. He's going to get moved into the bullpen because of an innings limit. Whereas with the Orioles, you have Dylan Bundy, who's suddenly looking like maybe your 1B to Chris Tillman at the top of that rotation, and he should be fine from an innings standpoint. I mean, this kind of works out in the Orioles' favor starting this season the way they did with Bundy.
Yeah, it really does. I agree. They don't have to worry about any of this. Certainly, it's not going to be a topic of conversation, I think. So really kind of interesting, but maybe similar to you know, what other teams have done with top prospects. David Price started in the bullpen before moving into that starting role. So I think, again, the Orioles didn't anticipate this happening this early, but the need called for it, and Bundy has certainly stepped up.
Yeah, and maybe Bundy's the biggest addition to this rotation that the team could have hoped for here down the stretch. But the other addition at the trade deadline, Wade Miley, comes over from Seattle. The Orioles didn't have to give up a whole lot to get him. He's a guy that the numbers don't stand out this year, 7-8 with an ERA pushing 5 and 19 starts. But Miley's always been a guy that'll be out there every fifth day. He's a guy that can eat up some innings. And considering where the Orioles were, what they had to give up, he seems like the best alternative they could have gone for and a nice fit into this team to help out that rotation.
Yeah, he does. They wanted a lefty. They wanted a lefty since they lost Lane Chen last year. So I think adding Wade Miley, him pitching as well as he's pitched here in the last month or so, is obviously huge. just getting to go to eight innings. He's averaged, I think, 193 over the last four seasons, and they need people to go deep into the games. Really been their issue all year, so I agree. Not a whole lot for them to go out there and get, and they didn't really give up too much. You know, Ariel Miranda, an okay pitching prospect, not one of their top guys, so I think they felt pretty good about that move.
Ian, we're going to get into Andrew Benintendi a little bit, the trade deadline, what went down, what didn't for the Red Sox. But let's start with this West Coast trip, which has been, well, certainly eventful, if nothing else. I mean, there has been some exciting baseball games out west for the Red Sox. Unfortunately, Tuesday night's game went exciting the wrong way. David Price, terrific for seven innings. They sent him back out for the eighth, and things just kind of unravel from there. The thing that I was surprised about, Ian, as they give up five runs in that eighth inning, end up blowing the 4-0 lead and losing the game, is you send Price out for the eighth. Absolutely, he had been tremendous that up to that point. He gives up the solo home run. Okay, it's a solo shot. It's still 4-1. But my thought was, then he gives up the next hit. And here's a guy that historically has been prone to big innings. I feel like you got to go get him at that point. They didn't, and it got worse and worse. Eventually, they did get Price out of there when it was 4-2, and then Fernando Abad gives up the three-run shot to Robinson Cano. But I just felt like the way David Price has been going, as well as he had pitched in that game, they had to go get him sooner. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought maybe John Farrell was a little bit slow on the draw on that particular move. I would have got him maybe one batter earlier. You know, four straight hits to start the inning, that's not good. And then Matt Barnes does a great job, but then you leave the new guy, Abad, to face one of the best hitters in the game, Robinson Cano, and just unraveled completely.
And I felt bad for Abad in a sense, because I just said it right there, but I pictured headlines across baseball with A-bad after his debut with the Red Sox, which isn't fair, but it just instantly popped into my head. Here's a guy that has been dominant this season against lefties, and obviously he's the guy the Red Sox get at the trade deadline from the Twins. They said send Pat Light to Minnesota, a middle of the kind of top 30 type prospect, a hard thrower, but a guy that's probably going to end up being a bullpen arm. But for Abad to debut like that, what a tough spot for a guy who's been so good this season in Minnesota. This is really the first chance for Red Sox fans to see him, and he gives up the three-run homer. I think things are going to get better for him, but how did he take that debut, and how was he after the game?
Yeah, he was fine. He seems like a pretty laid-back guy. He's got his head is in the right place. He wasn't hanging his head. Look, he was Cano was 1-for-11 off him before that at bat, so he had done a nice job. He just kind of left the pitch a little too much over the plate. But, you know, that's the reason they got this guy, to face guys like Robinson Cano. And John Farrell had been plotting that matchup for hours, really.
Right.
He thought, you know, at 2 in the afternoon, you know, if Robinson Cano comes in a key spot, I got to put in my new toy, my new lefty specialist there. And just didn't get the job done. But, you know, certainly you can't blame Abad for that game. Just kind of unraveled before that point.
Taking away, obviously, the game on Tuesday night, how valuable a piece can Abad be to have that guy that can just, when you have a tough spot with a tough lefty, you can just bring him in to, you would think, well more often than not, get that lefty out?
Yeah, I mean, they really have a nice compliment with Abad and Robbie Ross Jr., who's kind of done an underrated job for this team this year. And then you have Ziegler from the right side, who's really tough on righties, and Tozawa, who's, you know, really good against both righties and lefties. And I think they have a really good bullpen now. And last night, notwithstanding, I think, you know, you're going to see this team win a lot of games because of their bullpen in the late innings, and that's without even Koji Uehara. So if you ever get him back, that's even going to give you another weapon.
Yeah, and hopefully they do. So Abad was the last move the Red Sox make before the deadline. Obviously, they were busier than anyone earlier than anyone, really, leading up to the deadline. From what you've heard, was there other – I mean, we heard the rumors about Chris Sale, but it seemed like that was more rumor than anything else. Were there other big moves kind of brewing that didn't happen, or were just the asking price for players just way too big for Dave Dombrowski after he had already given up some key pieces?
Yeah, I think Dave got a sense that, look, a blockbuster deal is not going to be realistic. He talked to 20 out of the 29 other teams, and you know, had a good idea on asking price for things, and just decided he was better off with a complimentary piece. I think that's why they got Pomerantz as early as they did, because they didn't think another pitcher like that was going to become available for a reasonable price. And you know, for Chris Price, for Chris Dale, you're probably talking about three key prospects, and then maybe an everyday player as well. So that was going to be a huge, that was going to be a huge asking price for him.
What is it about the Subway Series? And it's the four-game set. They're switching ballparks halfway through. Sweetie, what makes this so special?
You have two very passionate fan bases, and regardless of how the teams are doing, I think you can tell that they want to come out and see them. I mean, I hear all the time people say they're tired of the Subway Series, but when you look up, there's still full houses in the ballparks, or close to it pretty much every time. So until you start seeing half the stands full, I won't believe people saying that they're tired of the Subway Series, unless they're from like California.
Yeah, you know, I was actually just talking to someone about this a couple hours ago. These games tend to be good. They tend to be close, tight, competitive games. And like you said, it doesn't really matter which team is heading in which direction and where they are in the standings. They always seem to be good games, whether it's a walk-off that we've seen multiple times in the Subway Series, or, Luis Castillo always comes to mind as one of those games that you remember. But even last night, a 10-inning game on a sacrifice fly, it's exciting. They're close games. You don't see blowouts one way or the other.
Absolutely. And I think the one thing that you notice is that both teams don't have to be in contention for the World Series. All you need is one team that needs to win games, and the other team's fan base wants to stop that from happening. So, like last year, these two teams met in September, and the Mets were going where they were going. I don't think the Yankee fans, felt like the games had a less meaning because you wanted to kind of beat the team or slow down the team that was going on their own.
Bragging rights is the basis for this whole thing in a lot of ways.
And it's interesting right now because you look at the records, almost identical, but when trade deadline comes around, the Mets are buyers, the Yankees are sellers, which still, the day after, just feels a little weird to say Yankees are sellers. But I think at this point they're still in the wild card race. We'll see what can happen. But when you look at this series as a whole, these four games, does it mean more to the Mets or the Yankees? We'll start with the Mets.
I think it has to be more for the Mets only because they're publicly going for it. They're all in. They traded for Jay Bruce and even a smaller deal for John Neese. And I agree with you. I think the Yankees can still get hot, can still make a run, even though they traded away some of their better players. It's possible. But for the Mets, it's what they're aiming to do. They're not looking to the future. They're not even looking to 2017 at this point. They're looking right now, these final 2 months, and making a similar type of run that they did last year. So if they wind up falling flat and losing 3 or 4 to the Yankees, that's more of a problem, I would say, for them than for a Yankees team that is okay to wrap its head around the concept of maybe not winning this
year. Yeah, listen, I think the Yankees have clearly laid out their plan that it's not going to be about 2016. They're talking about the future. They're talking about making some more moves when they get back to the American League ballpark with DH, and maybe shuffle the roster again. Gary Sanchez could be on his way very soon. One of their top prospects, good hitting catcher that they have in AAA. You've got other guys that you've been hearing about for a while, like Aaron Judge. Tyler Austin is having a good year for his space at AAA. These are the types of guys you're going to start to see. With those those at-bats coming at the expense of a guy like Alex Rodriguez. So this is not the Yankees you got used to. I've heard a lot of people say they're sellers for the first time since 1989. They traded Ricky Henderson. They didn't trade Don Mattingly. They didn't trade everybody else. They traded one player. This is the first time the Yankees have been sellers to this degree ever.
And it's funny you say that about the prospects coming in, because the Mets are kind of doing the opposite. They turned over their clubhouse to four new players. They shipped out Brandon Nimmo, who they still think is a huge part of their future, to bring in a utility man in Ty Kelly, because they want those at-bats now. They want those professional at-bats. They want to know what they're getting in a pennant race. You need to bring someone up in the eighth inning of the game to get a hit.
Well, plus, taking a page from not just the Yankees' book, but from a contending team's book, all last winter we heard Dilson Herrera's name as the guy who... But this is the guy who's going to step in at second base. This is why you can afford to let Daniel Murphy walk, because you're going to stop gap, and here comes Dilson Herrera. He's not going to be traded. Guess what? Yesterday he was traded. Yeah. So a little different perspective than we're used to seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And believe me, they didn't love the idea of trading Dilson Herrera, but it's something you're willing to do. These are the sacrifices you make when you want to go for it. You want to be in that
You have
mode.
A window.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can tell we're at Citi Field, by the way. I'm sure you can hear the planes overhead. Nothing we can do about that. We couldn't pause the flight patterns for this thing. But we talked about the Yankees selling, and I feel like one of the reasons they've always been buy, we're never going to rebuild, we're not a team that rebuilds, is that they didn't think the fans would accept that. But I feel like after yesterday, the fan base, for the most part, I think the educated fans who follow baseball know how this game works now, they're on board with this plan. They like what happened yesterday. They see what these prospects could become. They've seen what the Cubs have done with all their young players. And the fan base overall, I feel like, is okay with not a long rebuild, but hey, all right, let's maybe throw in the towel a little this year, maybe stumble early next year, and let's see these young guys start coming up.
If it works the plan where next year the Yankees are contending, the fan base, I'm sure, is okay.
Well, that's
okay
the pitch,
with,
right?
That's not how it works. No. I mean, I think you have to be realistic about what might happen. If you're going to rely on young players, you might stumble a little bit. And, you know, the Yankees' business model isn't necessarily built to rebuild. You're talking about a relatively new ballpark that you need to fill seats in. You know, the Cubs is a bad example. You're going to get 30,000 people coming up to Wrigley Field no matter what type of team is out there. It's not necessarily built around a winning team. The Yankee business plan can't sustain a couple of years of this. It's more with the idea of maybe it's reloading and not rebuilding. The educated fan, yes, but if, you know, you have to be prepared for the fact the Yankees might lose 90 games if they go full bore with kids. Now, if 35,000 people are there and they're watching that, I'm sure the Yankees are fine with that. But if they're not, you know, the fan that says we're okay with it, maybe they're home watching on TV, not sitting in the stands. You have to expect that if there are problems, growing pains, so to speak, that will affect attendance, and we'll see by how much. But that's where you find out how much people are actually willing to accept.
It's hard to go in between, though, and I know because I watched it with this other team with the Mets. They never did do it. Yes, they sold off Carlos Beltran at one point. They sold R.A. Dickey from prospects. But they never went and just blew up the roster like a lot of people thought they should at the time. Well, guess what? It took 5 long years of fourth-place finishes for them to get back to where they wanted to be. I think if you could, you know, tell Sandy Alderson that was going to happen and go back and do it, he might have done it a different way, a quicker way. And yes, it would have resulted in more losses in the short term, but in the long term, it might have taken 3 years instead of 5. So it's a very tough balance to strike if you're not trying to do it the Astros way or the Phillies way or the Cubs way. You're trying to be competitive in the short term while also building that long-term juggernaut.
Obviously, the Rays making some moves right before the deadline. We'll get into that a little bit and the new faces that are gone. But I want to start with Jake Odorizzi and his performance on Wednesday, because he's a guy that they held on to at the trade deadline. And it has to make you feel good as a team when there's all these guys you could possibly trade, Jake Odorizzi being one of them. They hang on to him, and his next start, he goes out, fires 6 scoreless innings, just 2 hits. He strikes out 6. They win easily. Was that as good as he's looked this season?
Well, I mean, and keep in mind, that's 3 consecutive scoreless starts for him. He's got, I believe it's 20 and two-thirds, or 22 and two-thirds scoreless innings in a row. So he's had 3 really good starts. And I think he's been as consistent, or more consistent probably, than anybody on the staff this year. So definitely a good one to hang on to. And, you know, he seems to think that he's, you know, really been kind of doing the same thing all year. But, you know, he's just getting better results for one reason or another right now.
All right, so they held on to. Matt Moore obviously is traded away to the Giants. But it's a nice package that they get back, because you get players that are big leaguers now, which you don't usually see at the trade deadline. But to be able to trade Matt Moore and get a Matt Duffy back, a guy who's been a major league player, who succeeded at the major league level already, albeit injured right now, but he'll be back shortly. And then they also get some prospects, Lucius Fox being really an intriguing one. He was a top 10 prospect for the Giants, still a youngster, still years away, but he's a talented up-the-middle player, a shortstop, and then they also get Michael Santos. So a nice little package for Matt Moore, and you knew that it was kind of a seller's market, and that proved out in many trades, and I think this was one of them, because I know I've talked to people on the other side of this, Bill. I've talked to Giants fans who weren't thrilled about this trade. I mean, they're happy to have Matt Moore, but they realize everything they gave up. So from the Rays' standpoint, is this exactly the kind of deal that they were hoping to get?
I think it is, because this guy is a, you know, a legitimate major league shortstop. Even though I found it interesting, you know, maybe he's just a humble guy, but, you know, he said, I will have to, you know, basically he said, I will have to transition back to playing shortstop, because he's been giving it his all to be a third baseman for the Giants with, you know, since they have Crawford at shortstop. But, you know, he's got the body for shortstop, and, you know, it's kind of that tall, rangy thing. And talking to hitting coach Derek Shelton, you know, he says he really likes his swing. It's a more level swing. He makes good contact. So I think he's going to do a lot of good things for him. You know, on the receiving end of this one, obviously, was Brad Miller, who's actually played better in the field for the past month. I don't think it sat real well with him, and he mentioned that. Even though he's, you know, this guy is really a good clubhouse guy and an upfront guy, but, you know, and he set the record for a single season record for home runs by a shortstop. But I really think that he's going to be more valuable in a utility role, kind of like a Ben Zobrist, and you know, going forward, I think we'll see him a lot at first base once Duffy's back, and I expect Duffy to be with the team probably by the end of the week.
Yeah, and you mentioned first base, and obviously that's been a trouble spot for this team all year, but Miller has a bat that can profile there, as well as obviously it profiles kind of anywhere in the infield. So I think as a whole, even if Miller's not thrilled right now, I think long-term you look at this and you see a stronger team overall, and a team that knew it had a lot of pitching, knew it needed to get better offensively, and they did it with this trade. Now, that wasn't the only made they moved. That was the big one, but they also send Pierce back to the Orioles. He'll have a third tour of duty in Baltimore, and then they also traded away Guyer. They get an interesting piece in Pierce. Jonah Heim, a catching prospect, comes over, and I think he's still a question mark of what he could become, but catching prospects don't grow on trees. So to be able to get that for a rental, basically, that you had in Pierce that you had just signed this year, I think that's a pretty good job by Silverman and company as well.
Well, probably the only reason he's available is because he hasn't been hitting. He's supposed to be a pretty solid catcher. So, you know, we'll see how he develops. I think it's my understanding that he has pitched some, so who knows, that might be something up the road if the catching doesn't work out. But I did ask them about what their intentions were for him, and it is as a catcher.
Gregor, team's right in the thick of things right now after the trade deadline, and they made some moves at the deadline. Interesting moves. They did what they had to do, I think, in getting starting pitching. And then we're going to get into the Aaron Sanchez situation a little bit first. But let's start with the deadline. They get Francisco Liriano from the Pirates. They get Bolsinger, although I realize he's down in the minor leagues. And then they also get Feldman to help out in the bullpen. The Liriano trade was fascinating to me, I think, for both teams, because you get Liriano plus a couple of prospects, and they're not just throw-in minor leaguers. These are guys with some definite upside possibility, and then Hutchison goes back the other way. This surprised me from a Pirates standpoint, but for the Blue Jays, I just thought this is a great trade, regardless of what you get from Liriano, and hopefully he can kind of rediscover what he's been in the past.
Yeah, it surprised me as well. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of Blue Jays fans over the years that have been waiting for this team to act like a big market. And I think the move that they made this week was what you would associate with a big market club. I mean, in a lot of ways, they used cash to buy these prospects and also get a potential fit in the rotation, not only this year, but next year. And it was a case of the Pirates wanted to shed that salary. Liriano's making $13.6 million this year. He's making $13.6 million next year. So they were looking for a little bit of flexibility. And the only way the Jays were going to provide that was if they got a couple of prospects in the deal as well. And like you said, these aren't throwaway guys. These were two of the top 10 prospects in that system. And so the Blue Jays, really kind of in a unique way, were able to make a move that you know, helps them in the immediate future and then also provides some more long-term future as well. It's pretty rare that you get a contending team that is able to do both of those things in the same move. And this team really needed pitching depth as well. So when you add in Lariano with the other guys that you mentioned, this team needed that, because Hutchison was the only guy who was that backup type starter. Now they've replaced the depth there to take his spot. And then they've also brought in Lariano, who's had a very down season, but has a lot of upside there. And the Blue Jays obviously hope and think that they can help turn him around.
Yeah, the prospects, Harold Ramirez, an outfielder, Reese McGuire, a catching prospect who I guess can really catch it. The question is whether or not he'll be able to hit enough to be a regular, but two young guys to add into that system, and a system that needed that boost too. You mentioned Liriano's struggles, and there is some worry there. I mean, this year the numbers are not good. The ERA almost 5.5, and that's in the National League Central. Now he's moving to the American League East, better lineups, designated hitter. But on the other hand, he's reunited with Russell Martin, and they had some real success together with the Pirates when they were both there. Is there a thought at all that Martin's presence and his receiving skills can help out Liriano?
The Jays certainly hope so, and they spent a lot of time talking about that this week. And you look at Liriano's career ERA, and his ERA with Martin is by far the lowest than with any other catcher he's ever worked with. So clearly they figured something out in 2013 and 2014 when the two of them worked there. Those were two of the best years of Liriano's career. So Martin saw him when he was at his best. I think the hope is that, you know, once Martin gets a look at him in his first start and gets a look at some video this week about what was going on with Liriano, that he'll have some tips as well. The only hesitation I have there is the fact that Ray Searidge is one of the best in the business in Pittsburgh as a pitching coach, and you know he helped turn Jay Happ's career around. You would think that if anybody could help Liriano, it would be him. But the other flip side of that too is that sometimes guys just need a change of scenery. We've seen it time and time again, where they, you know, get put into a new spot. Suddenly they don't have to quite think about and reflect on the previous starts they made for that organization. Liriano, in his first media availability with his new club, was talking about how, you know, he kind of compounded his issues, but he would try to make up for his last start with a really good one, and he would want to make amends. Well, sometimes things can snowball on you when you have that approach. And so maybe a fresh start is all he needs too, but Martin certainly won't hurt. I think if anything, he's going to help, and it'll be interesting to see where those two go from here.
Feldman had a tough first go of it on having to pitch against his former team the day after pitching for them, so that was a tough start. But he's a proven guy with a lot of experience that hopefully will help this team as well. You have this new-look bullpen as well with Joaquin Benoit, Grilly's out there, and, of course, Osuna's still there at the back end. What's the feeling about this bullpen? Obviously, if you end up having Aaron Sanchez in it as well, it's even better. But is this a bullpen that's October ready?
Strictly from a bullpen perspective, if Sanchez goes down there, I think it is. That obviously takes a toll on the starting rotation. But that bullpen with the Sanchez down there is starting to look pretty good. I mean, Jason Grilly has been lights out ever since he came over here. I mean, his strikeout rate is ridiculous. He's really proved to be a really solidifying force in the eighth inning. And Joaquin Benoit has been a pleasant surprise as well. Talking about guys change the scenery, he's a perfect example of that. So is Grilly. Benoit, the command has been an issue, but so far in Toronto, he's looked pretty good. You could do a lot worse for guys coming in potentially in the sixth inning. I mean, if you're looking at a bullpen that potentially goes 7, 8, 9, with Grilly, Sanchez, and then Osuna, that's pretty solid. You're able to mix in Brett Cecil there as well. He still needs to get fully back on track, but the hope is that he will. And then you add Benoit into that mix as well, and it's a pretty nice unit. I think that could be October ready, and Feldman is the guy who provides a lot of insurance down there in terms of adding length, and they didn't really have that prototypical long reliever, and that's why the Jays multiple times this year have run into problems with just an exhausted bullpen, because they have to, whenever a starter doesn't go deep into a game, which doesn't happen very often, but when it does, or when they go to extra innings, they didn't have that guy who could eat up multiple innings. They had to go to multiple relievers in order to get the job done. Now they've got Feldman to take on that role.